This Week in Radio Tech, episode 235, is brought to you by Lavvo and the new Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the radio console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. By Telos and the Telos VX Voice over IP Broadcast Phone System. Powerful, flexible, and scalable phones never sounded this good. And by Axia Audio and the Axia Radius Networked IP Audio Console. Throw your budget curve and meet Radius. Hey, fixing broadcast gear is difficult enough at ground level. What's it like to troubleshoot, diagnose, and repair broadcast systems 300, 600, or 1,200 feet above ground? Well, Chris Tobin advises about what can go wrong and some common remedies, and we analyze an antenna repair by Tower Pro John Hedish while he's 920 feet above the ground. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. Glad that you're here. This is the show. We talk about everything to do with radio technology, audio, RF, sometimes mechanical stuff like this show, stuff that's up high, made of metal and Teflon and brass and stainless steel up on a tower. And sometimes we got to take really expensive gear up there and try to fix it. That's going to be interesting. Our co-host on the show, Chris Tobin, joins us, the best-dressed engineer in radio from Manhattan, New York. Chris, thanks for coming in. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. I just got back from the CCW Satcom show, the expo here in New York City.
For those of you who don't know, that means counterclockwise.
Counterclockwise for some, and others, it actually means the content and communications world, the Satellite Communications Conference and Expo. Held at the Jacob Javits Center here in New York City.
Hey, satellite communications. Now, you know, before the internet came along, satellite was hot because, you know, if you wanted to get audio, video, telephone calls, data, stock market out to a bunch of people and even return data, satellite's what you used. You know, in the 80s, especially, we were hot to trot on satellite. 90s came along. We were still hot to trot satellite because the internet sucked. What's the prospect for satellite over the next 10, 15, 20 years? What do you think?
Actually, satellite's doing very well, depending on the sector, the business sector you're in. It's still, in some cases, depending on your industry, still the most economical or cost-benefit way of distributing from a single point to many points. It's used a lot in emergency operations where landlines, or we'll call terrestrial connectivity is decimated, so the only way you're going to hear or talk is through the satellite, through the sky. So, you know, places like Haiti where there was, you know, the terrible conditions there, or an earthquake zone or things like that.
And
the satellite industry continues to grow and shift. So the latest now is Ka satellite, right? Is that right? And that's really frequency, super high frequency. I was looking at some stuff today, and, you know, it's the funniest thing. If you can picture a shoebox, okay, the size of a shoebox, and a small little pie plate in front of it at a 45-degree angle, at Ka band, you can now put yourself on the on a satellite from outside.
Wow.
That's how the technology has shifted from the days of C band, where it would take a pie plate the size of a car.
the antenna, size of a car.
The antenna. Sure. And then the actual transmission device would be about the size of a coffin. So that's basically what you got.
Car in a coffin. Well, it's the times, they are changing.
They are indeed.
Wow. Hey, in fact, we may touch on satellite a bit during the show, and we've done some shows about satellite, and we could probably have another one to catch us up on the technology. We had a guest, a guy from a company I believe is called Caillou or KU. Anyway, they were doing installations out in I don't know, Papua New Guinea and places like that. Just crazy places that the only way you could get there was with satellite. So I guess that's a good point. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavvo. Lavvo, maker of this really cool audio console. If you have ever dreamed of controlling an audio console from a touchscreen, well, you need to look into the Lavvo Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Mixing Console. Why is it called virtual? Because there's no actual piece of hardware with faders that you move and buttons that you actually depress and knobs that you actually turn. It's all represented to you in a gorgeous, gorgeous multi-touch touchscreen interface. And that is that interface is simply an off-the-shelf HP multi-touch PC. It's running Windows 8. The application takes the whole screen, so it doesn't look like Windows, but it looks like an audio console. And I got to tell you, these guys at Lava, they've been designing consoles for a long, long time. They do big consoles. They do consoles that do surround sound and just multi-channel stuff for big television productions and symphony halls and TV stations, remote trucks and all that. And now they're doing consoles that are smaller, more appropriate for smaller venues like radio stations. And this crystal clear console is pretty interesting. It consists of a one rack unit box that goes in a rack. It doesn't have to be close to the multi-touch PC. It can be off somewhere else, although it does have inputs and outputs on it for your local sources, like your microphones, okay? It's got a couple of mic inputs. It has some line-level analog inputs and some AES inputs, and as well as some line-level analog outputs and AES outputs. Of course, it has some GPIO, so you can turn on your on-air light, your tally light, let folks know not to come in the room. And it's got the other outputs that you need, like your speaker outputs, your headphone outputs. So that is a one RU box. It has the entire mixing engine in there, and that is where also there's an Ethernet connection. That's where you can connect to your other studios, to other gear, using the Ravenna AOIP standard, which by its nature contains AES-67, the standard that AOIP standard that you've heard a lot about, that's now an actual year old. Yeah, it's a little over a year old now. Standard from the Audio Engineering Society. There's power supply redundancy also. The mic preamps are fantastic low noise preamps. There are two separate amplified headphone outputs. The console, the virtual console, features three stereo mixing groups, program 1, 2, and a record bus. Plus, all the things you'd expect. A cue bus, pre-fader level, if you will, precision stereo meters, programmable scene presets can recall, every detail. And one of the cool things, when you design a console completely in software, you can have the buttons be entirely context sensitive. So if you touch an options button above the mic fader, what you get are options that have to do with a microphone, like presetting the level for a particular mic or a particular guest. Get their audio range just right so your fader is sitting in the right range. That kind of thing. That kind of thinking has gone into the design of this console. If you would, if you're interested in a multi-touch touchscreen console, someday everything I think will be like this. It's really cool. I can't wait till someday we have haptic feedback, on the screen itself. I think the military has that. But Lavo is letting you just look at it and run the faders up and down yourself. They got the algorithms down really good. Check it out on the web at Lavo, L-A-W-O. It's a German word, L-A-W-O, pronounced Lavo.com. Lavo.com. And look for in the radio products, the radio consoles, and find the crystal clear console. Oh, on the webpage, there's also a short video of Mike Dosh, Director of Virtual Radio Projects at Lavo. He is demonstrating how the console works. Check it out. And thanks to Lavo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, Mr. Tobin, we were going to do some talking about towers on this week in Radio Tech. And I didn't really want to talk about the mechanics and the steel and the guy wires. That is a great subject, but it's not really what I wanted to cover today. I was interested in covering more of the electronics side of what happens on a tower. Some of the things that have to do with, they're mechanical, they're electrical, electromechanical. They have to do with RF, and I'm talking about antennas and feed line, maybe strobe light systems. And with antennas, the interesting and oftentimes difficult problems that can crop up. It's hard enough for us as engineers to fix a problem on the ground with a workbench and good lighting and good weather and no 50 mile an hour winds. But if you're trying to solve an interesting antenna tuning problem on a tower, or maybe there's some reflected power coming from a 12 bay antenna and you don't know where it's coming from, that's got to get solved. And it may take a person with some real skills to handle that. Let's talk about that. Chris, what are your thoughts on the whole subject of troubleshooting up high? Hello, Chris. Is he there?
I don't know. That's weird. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You can hear me, but the video is not moving anywhere.
I'm
relaying
not.
Four different relays in the Skype connection. That's why. Last week there was zero.
Oh, gosh. Well, I tell you what. I'll be glad to continue on for just a moment with some thoughts if you want to get reconnected. How about that?
I guess we'll have to give that a try.
Okay, good. All right. So here, I'm going to go back to Chris and ask him for his thoughts. But here are some of my thoughts. I said it takes a special kind of talent, a special person. And a little bit later in the show, we have a video of my friend John Hedish. He runs a small tower company here in Middle Tennessee, where I live. And John has, you know, the skills that it takes not only to climb towers and to know, you know, to be safe about that kind of thing. Thanks. But also to use some various pieces of equipment that you might take up a tower, connect to various places in the feed line or into the antenna, and find out where the problem is. And this is really sophisticated stuff. You can do some of this from the ground if you're well coordinated with the guy on the tower. But I'll tell you what, it can be really tough working, you know, 600, 800, 1,200, 2,000 feet above the ground, solving what, you know, is a very expensive problem that can happen on towers. So, Chris, you're back. Let's talk about that subject. Go ahead.
I'm back, hopefully moving in live video and color. How it goes. No? Yeah, there
yep.
We go.
Okay.
All right, very good. Well, as I was going to say, yes, tower work, towers in general are definitely something you have to take very seriously. The best thing to start with is make sure you can find yourself a tower crew or a company that is well-known, does a lot of work, maybe in the cellular industry, so they're constantly busy, and you have a good relationship with, because it's important, as Kirk just pointed out, that if you have the guy up on the tower working with troubleshooting and you're at the base, you want somebody who gets it, knows, understands that it's going to take a little time to figure things out, and is willing to work with people on the ground when there's you know, time is of the essence. I can tell you that I've worked with a couple of crews where they knew their stuff, and it was pretty easy to get things done in the bad weather at the heights that they were working at. So that's the first thing I always tell folks. Find the right tower crew. Otherwise, you'll be in big trouble.
You know, just how you do that might be kind of interesting. But let me ask you a question. Do you feel, you know, the cellular industry has sprung up over the last 20 years or so? You know, the 25 years ago, there were barely any cell towers across the country, and now they're just everywhere. There's some on a hilltop just around the next ridge from my house here. Do you feel that the level of technical expertise of tower crews has gone up since the cellular industry has required so many tower crews and some sophistication in putting up antennas, aiming them, making sure they work properly?
Yeah, I would say I don't think it ever went down. I think what's happened is the cellular industry as a client has made demands of the tower industry, the tower crews, to be on their game. Because as we know with the cellular industry, any interference or any time that there's a cellular site that can't function, that's thousands of dollars per minute that's lost. So the phone companies go to great lengths to make sure that the industries they talk to or work with are on the top of their game. So, you know, maybe by default, more tower crews have become more skilled, but I wouldn't say the skills went away. They were probably far and few. But yeah, some of the crews out there now, just all they do is cellular. And if they go to broadcast, it's sort of like, okay, what do you just to extend? How do we do this?
Yeah, here's what surprised me. We'll watch this video in just a little bit, but my experience with tower crews, realized that I worked in small markets. You worked generally in larger ones, but in small markets where I worked at, we'd hire a tower crew, and what we got was a tower crew. We didn't get any troubleshooting capability except, you know, yeah, we'll unbolt this connection, open it up, and look and see if there's water, if there's soot in there from a flame out inside. We'll make sure the bullet's not split, you know, where the coax is, where the hard line connects together. We'll look for leaks in a coax, you know, that kind of stuff. But never anything more sophisticated than that up on the tower. The most sophisticated thing that I'd ever had done by a tower crew was to disconnect the antenna and temporarily put a dry load, a dummy load, on top of the coax, so we could then run tests from the ground, either with a time domain reflectometer or an admittance bridge or whatever it might be, you know, an SWR bridge, and so we could see if the conditions changed between antenna, you know, determine is the problem in the coax or the problem in the antenna. So that's the most sophisticated service I ever had. But we're going to watch a video in a little while that shows John Hedish using some sophisticated gear, and I'm not even sure what it is. Maybe you can help identify it when we watch the video later on. So that's, to me, that is a really big step up, where you've got some tower guys, and maybe they were available, you know, maybe they had this kind of expertise 20 years ago. I just didn't get that because that's not what we hired. You know, for me, the consulting engineer, right, was on the ground with his vector impedance bridge or his time domain reflectometer. So how things changed in your mind? Same now or different now?
Well, they definitely have changed. I will say that even I've worked with crews the same way. You send them up, and they basically pop open the termination, and off you go. Mm-hmm. So I would say what's changed is that because of the increased need for mobile devices and those types of transmitter sites, a lot of the cell tower companies that did just basic tower climbing, basic cable assembly, have stepped up and now decided they have to do more diagnostics and work with the consultants. Otherwise, basically, they wouldn't get any business.
Yeah,
Because I know working with one tower crew for many years, they were strictly pretty much broadcast radio, TV, and they got the occasional 9X job. Okay, and that's how far back this goes. So then all of a sudden, after two or three jobs, and they were being required to certify their installations, make sure that ground connections meet the standards that are in the industry and everything else, they started realizing maybe we need to up our game and start really going after this business. And now, many years later, they're like the number two in the tri-state area for tower work when it comes to cellular.
Something that and we'll see if we can get your video going again. Something that I've noticed, though, I guess a big change is the size of the test gear. 20 years ago, it wasn't possible or it wasn't practical to take a time domain reflectometer up the tower because the thing weighed 50 pounds and it was as big as a suitcase. And now you've got things that are much more handheld in size, virtually the size of a thick iPad. You can get oscilloscopes, time domain reflectometers, and various different kinds of equipment in that size of a package. I guess a lot of what we're the ideal situation with any antenna and coax is that power, RF power, leaves the transmitting device. Doesn't matter if it's an FM transmitter, television, cellular, microwave. This power leaves the transmitter, leaves that final amplifier there. It travels up the coax, or maybe in a case of a really high frequency, a waveguide. And the idea is it's not going to be impeded, reflected. It's going to see a constant impedance as it travels, hopefully smoothly, up this coax. And then it's going to reach the antenna. And the antenna is supposed to be matched or tuned such that it presents a non-reactive load at the end of the coax at the same impedance as the coax. That's the whole idea here for maximum power transfer from the transmitter through the coax and into the antenna. That's the ideal. Anything that varies from that is non-ideal. Anything that varies from that will result in power, RF power, getting reflected like a mirror or a partial mirror getting reflected back down to the transmitter. And that's in almost every case, that's what we're trying to avoid, reflected power. We want all that power to flow smoothly all the way to the antenna. And then in the antenna, and I like to think of antennas this way. Chris, you tell me if you think this is nuts. I always thought of an antenna as an interface between the electrical world and the atmospheric world. And, our atmosphere tends to have a characteristic impedance. And so really an antenna is an impedance. I mean, it's a device that turns, the electrical oscillating wave into a magnetic field, an electric field and magnetic field. And to do that most efficiently, it's an impedance matching device to match the impedance of the coax and the transmitter to the impedance of the atmosphere. I may be all wet on that, but when you look at a microwave horn that we used to use, like for AT&T long lines, and they had what started out as a waveguide goes up to into a horn that gradually spreads out and matches the impedance to that of the outside world, the atmosphere. That's the result of the maximum transfer. Am I all wet on that, Chris?
No, not at all. Actually, it's probably the best way to put it. You could go from the electrical to the atmospheric. The atmospheric would be the free space attenuation in the air. That's a known constant. And yes, the waveguide is a boundary device. It could be rectangular or circular, and that guides the RF signal, the electrical part, up to a path, and then when it gets that horn, that widening space, it shoots it out and makes sure that it gets to the other end.
So the point there was anything that disturbs that relationship, and it's really a physical world thing. I mean, coaxial cable is the size and shape that it is because that's what works well. And 50 ohms, not only was it a standard we came up with, but it also happens to be convenient for the size of parts and just getting things to work well. If our standard was 4,000 ohms, then it might be more difficult to make things work as well. So am I right? Anything that disturbs this efficient transfer of electricity or of signal to the outside world, that's where our problems begin.
Yes, yes. And that's when you then you start getting into, after you've cleared the problem with the line tuning, because it's basically what you're doing is you're tuning the line to the antenna. After you've got that matched and working, then you have to worry about the physical world outside around the antenna and what effects that has on it. But yes, the line tuning is key.
Gotcha. So, and this also explains why and different antennas are different shapes and different sizes. So, you know, and we as broadcasters, broadcast engineers, we're pretty familiar with the shape and size of an FM antenna. And there are different designs, some kind of proprietary, others just, you know, really well known. There's the good old, you know, the double arrowhead design that I guess Jampro made famous and other companies too. There's the rototiller design that ERI made famous there. And before we had those circular polarization designs, we had designs that were dipoles. They were, you know, dipoles up in the air, stacked up. They tended to be, there were vertical dipoles, and there are ways of doing it horizontally as well, horizontal dipoles. And then I guess one of the first circular antennas was the ring stub design, where there's a ring of an antenna. That's the horizontal part. And then just as the rings come around and come together, they turn different directions, one up, one down, and that makes the vertical component of the antenna. And so what you got was a horizontal radiation and a vertical radiation out of the same piece of bent metal. So that was an early circular design. But those all look different from other designs. Like, remember television batwing antennas? Can you tell me anything about how those things worked? How did a batwing antenna function?
Basically, the batwing, if memory serves me right, it's been a while. I watched one come down a couple of years back. It's basically a dipole radiator in front of a mesh. So if you could picture, you know, the batwing was the shape. I'm using my fingers to make the shape of bat wings.
Yeah.
And that was basically your ground plane. And then in front of that was a dipole that radiated against it and created the pattern because
the bat wings themselves didn't – okay.
Yeah, and the TV signal is horizontal. So that's what they did.
Okay.
That's what it was. So the bat wings was popular because it was broadband. You can tune it. You can do a lot. You could shape the signal. Because then they moved – if you're in UHF, you have the slotted antenna, so it's a pole – with slots in it, and the inside is hollow, and those slots are cut in certain wavelength sizes to radiate the signal out and create a pattern as well. Now, as you mentioned earlier, antennas have different shapes and sizes due to the frequency. So the best way to understand that physical being is to look at a piano and look at the strings. The lower in frequency, the larger the diameter. The higher in frequency, smaller the diameter of the string. Same is true with antennas, the RF. RF works in the same fashion. So mid-frequency, we'll call it that, FM band 88 to 108 megahertz is somewhat of a relatively average size thickness. Go lower in frequency to say an AM antenna, and what do you have? You have 2 feet, 3 feet in width, and several hundred feet in height. Go to the other direction, and let's go to say our Wi-Fi antenna, and the Wi-Fi antenna, I'm holding a similar type thing in my hand, now becomes something about the length of someone's hand open, and it's about half the diameter of your finger.
Yeah,
and that's the higher frequency. So there we go. We just went the full spectrum from several hundred feet high to several feet wide to, a wavelength at FM is about 5 feet, 6 feet in length. So we just take that horizontal pole of a 5 foot antenna, twist it to shape either a circular thing or a circle with little tops and bottoms, and there's your antenna.
So, What are some of the things that typically go wrong with antennas? So we as broadcasters, let's stick in the realm of FM because a lot of the listeners and viewers to our show are engineers that take care of FM stations. I take care of several myself. And so what are the most common things that go wrong in the world of FM on towers between the coax or sectionalized hardline or antennas with power dividers or end-fed, center-fed? Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, let's see. Things that go wrong, and we're not because of installation or anything, just normal operating parameters. Typically, depending on what part of the world, a country you're in, if you say we would say the Northeast, what you'll have during the summer months is very extreme humid and sticky conditions. And as we know, humidity, moisture is a very good conductor of electricity, so RF will find its way around that. So depending on the age and installation or the stresses on the tower and the antenna itself, you run the risk of things shorting out. And something shorts out at a high power FM, You know, the end result sometimes is a black puff of smoke and a hole in the antenna or yeah. the transmission line. And then go to the other end of the spectrum if it's during the winter months and you're in the northeast or northwest and you have conditions of icing. Ice adds weight to a structure, and depending on how your structure is designed and how the antenna cable transmission line is attached to that structure, as it twists, that puts stress on the wire. So think of it as like if you're pulling cable in a pipe in your office, you're in the shop or studio. You know, when you pull on it, you're stretching. So picture a several hundred feet of 1 5/8 hanging on a tower. Hopefully the hangers are holding it in place so it's not stretching. But now add ice to that and then have the tower twisting. Yeah. Now, it may not seem like much, but when I was working with gentlemen, the folks at ERI, Tom Silliman and his team once, and the tower guys were explaining the physics behind icing and twisting of a tower and what happens. And a lot of times it's over a period of time. This doesn't happen in one season. But eventually, as it's twisting and moving, you can stress the transmission line. And if you have several splices in the line or one or two connections, they get stressed. And then a leak forms. And then your nitrogen leaks out. And air gets in, and things happen. That's the broad, you know, what could go wrong in an FM site outside of, say, a lightning strike or nearby lightning strike on that case. Or let's see what else. Oh, you know, it's another common thing that happens with towers that goes wrong.
What's that?
Tower climbers working on your tower, maybe not your tower, maybe on a shared tower, working on someone else's system, stepping on your transmission lines or bumping your stuff and lose. Yeah. I'll tell you this. Couple of years ago, while working at the Empire State Building, trying to troubleshoot a problem with the FM master antenna system, it was discovered that one of the transmission lines got stepped on. And, you know, how many things are up there? There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a perfect example. Everything's working just fine until somebody slips, hits it. The transmission line looks normal because it's hard to see if it's bent or damaged. And then over time, because it's 100 kilowatts of RF going through the transmission line, something fails, you know. You never know when that happens. It's not like you notice it.
You know, you brought up something. First of all, you mentioned, you know, the holding all that line up. And so let's say you're using semi-flexible coax, not hard rigid transmission line. And you've got what they call a Kellum grip that works like Chinese fingers. Every couple hundred feet or so, you put a Kellum grip on the coax and then it hangs, you know, the Kellum grip is attached to the tower and it hangs by that. You've got to, and of course, those need to be placed strategically so that the line is supported in several places, depending on how long it is, and it's equally supported. So you don't want all the weight on the flange at the connector at the top of the coax. I've had that happen before. I worked for a little station in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and we noticed that our signal was just over time getting worse and worse. And sometimes we were getting after a rainstorm, we get some terrible reflected power. The station wasn't all that powerful. I think it was just a kilowatt FM transmitter, like a Collins, 820 D transmitter. But it was just getting worse and worse. Well, we got a tower crew up there. And this was my first experience with FM antennas. The crew got up there and found out that the outer conductor of the coax had broken and pulled away from the outer conductor of the connector. This is an 1 5/8 coax. And all that was left was the inner conductor of the coax, just barely making connection with the bullet that was pushed into it from the dual bullet at the connector. And so it was mechanically attached a few feet lower, but apparently, you know, it had slipped down and weight over the years. And then here's the thing: we were talking about stretching and some twisting, vibration. If you ever go spend some time on a tower and you just sit up there during a windstorm, or just during some wind will sit there and vibrate the tower depending on all kinds of torsional values and moments and things like that. But you can get a tower that just sits there and the antenna just back and forth. And, you know, for days, weeks, months, years on end, but every time the wind blows, it sits there and vibrates. You know that's got to be doing some bad things to the coax, to the rigid transmission line, and to the bullets as they sit and wiggle for years. And then something bad's going to happen. And there you go.
Well, that's Chris, absolutely right.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been up on towers. I've gone, let's see, that was the highest I've been, 300 feet maybe, 3 and change. And sometimes one of the jobs I did many years ago, I remember going up, it was about 3 and change, and I had to sit and wait. because one of the other guys were coming up with some tools, and we had hoisted up, I think it was 7/8 line for a Marty RPU antenna system. And we hoisted it up, and there were a couple of issues we had, so we had to wait for some stuff to come up. And as I'm sitting up there, you know, so to speak, sitting, you exactly what you described takes place. One, the wind is blowing through your ears and around you, and it's very noisy. And then there's this very subtle feeling as if the earth is moving beneath your feet, though you're hanging from you're standing on the ladder ledge of a tower and belted on. But you feel the movement, and you sort of become, you realize where you are and what's going on and why things happen on a tower the way they do, and why tower crews and the standards that they follow are specific to, you know, how to tighten a bolt, what's used to tighten a bolt, what type of metal is used for the bolts on a tower, you know, all these methods, and why would you, you know, lanyard your tools to your wrist when you're on a tower, things like that. So it's the environment on the tower is not as pristine as you might think.
It is not. I've been surprised several times climbing towers as just how much vibration and torsional woes were going on. We were talking about wavelength earlier, and you mentioned that, you know, FM wavelength and how the higher the frequency, the lower the wavelength. I just happened to, on a shelf over here in the office, have this. It's a KU-band LNB, low noise block amplifier. And this is the end that most people are familiar with. This is where an F connector and an RG, you know, piece of RG6 coax, typically with an F connector on it, will connect and take this back inside to a satellite receiver inside the building. And this end is the end that connects, that bolts to the ring mount on the satellite dish. Well, if you look closely there, and let's see if my camera will do that. That little piece of white there, that's Teflon, and that little piece of Teflon is actually covering up the antenna. That's the actual antenna. That's all it is. It's less than 1/4 inch long, and it's just a piece of metal cut to a very precise length, and that antenna goes inside. And now, Chris, would that be 1/4 wavelength of this frequency? Is that what that antenna probably is?
A KU is 14 gig. It could be. It could be 1/4 wave.
It wouldn't be a lot less than 1/4 wavelength. It wouldn't have good transfer. No. So the big square, the big rectangular area, if you can put me on again, the big rectangular area there is the size of the waveguide. If this were being carried by waveguide, it would be that size. And then the little antenna inside there is what transmits energy into the waveguide or receives it back out. In this case, the waveguide is just a little short thing that goes to, you know, where the ring is on the front on the feed horn of the satellite dish. So antennas come in all shapes and sizes. That's one of the little bitty ones. What can go wrong here? Well, not a lot, but you know, we had an episode of This Week in Radio Tech years ago called Bees in the Feed Horn.
What goes wrong with a satellite downlink? Well, let's see. It goes out of alignment. Somebody pokes the dish. The LNB may just fail. What do you got?
I took the cover off, and you know, it's a solid block here. They don't want any moisture gets in this. It's really bad.
And also you have to remember too, at those frequencies, you don't want noise. You don't want anything else. Because why? Low noise block converter is what it says. Low noise. You're trying to capture a signal. Now, mind you, you're trying to capture a radio signal 22,000 miles above the Earth's surface.
It's from space.
You're also putting that. Yes, not a comet, not a Rosetta, but you're trying to get it from this little, what looks like a VW bus flying in space there, you know, in a figure eight above the Earth. And that little 1/4 wave antenna has to pick the signal out. So just, you can just imagine how much electronics has to be used to make the noise floor really low.
Oh, yeah.
14
yeah.
gigahertz to try and yeah. pick out that signal.
And they have to, a little droplet of water, as I was getting to, represents a huge bunch of inductance or capacitance or something. It really screws with the circuitry. The circuits have got to be bone dry. You can't have, you know, bits of moisture landing here and there on the circuit boards because the frequencies are so high, the wavelengths are so short, and the tolerances are so tight in the tuned circuitry that's in there that a drop of water would just totally screw it up.
And don't forget, a drop of water at KU frequencies is the resonant frequency of the signal. So you would actually wipe it out.
There you go. Yep. Absorb all the signal right there. In fact,
that's it.
If engineers watching or listening to the podcast here, you probably deal with 950 megahertz gear. You might deal with STL transmitters and receivers. And if you're like me, you have found out the hard way that a drop of water at the wrong place inside an N connector that's typically used with, half-inch coax or LMR 600 coax or 7/8 coax, a drop of water in the wrong place in an N connector, signal's over, game's over. You got, it's awful at that point.
Yeah, I mean, moisture in general, water in general, when it comes to electrical devices, in this case, RF signals, they don't mix very well. They don't do that very well at all.
Yeah, well, no kidding. So, I want to hit one other subject here before we go to our next break. And that, on the phone, you and I were talking about this issue that comes up from time to time, and I think it's typically called passive intermodulation.
Yes, that's right? Correct.
Passive intermodulation. Tell us what that is. I got a story to tell about that from Memphis, Tennessee, and a 300 kilowatt FM station, and the havoc wreaked there. But how would you define what is passive intermodulation, and what kind of problems does it cause?
Okay, I'm assuming. I'll make the assumption, and I probably shouldn't. We'll do the whiteboard as to why you don't assume. And anyway, moving right along with that joke, passive intermodulation, as the term says, it's passive. Intermodulation takes place in many things, in many devices, many circuits. Intermodulation is basically the mixing of more than one signal, two, three, four. And then out of those summing of the signals is a resultant third or fourth signal. That's active. That's when you intentionally are actively mixing signals together. For example, a transmitter site that has more than one transmitting emitter, one transmitting antenna. So you have two FM antennas on a tower. They mix. Hopefully, they are separated in such a way that the frequencies don't mix and create a third frequency smack in the middle of a TV channel. Oops. Yes, I did work at a place that had that problem. That was fun. Mm. So then you have what's called passive intermodulation. And passive intermodulation has become more prevalent in the last several years because of the mobile industry's need to have high-density cell sites. Okay, we'll call them that. And passive is a result of connectors that aren't properly terminated. Maybe environmental, where you have a railing, a handrail on a staircase, and the joints where the bolt of the railing connects to the wall or a support structure become corroded, rust. And then, believe it or not, because this railing and the rusted bolt that's holding it to the metal support structure happens to be in the near field of a antenna, a radio signal, the radio signal actually excites the corrosion. That takes you back to the early days of radio reception known as the cat's whisker.
yes, the diode. Crystal radio. Yeah.
That's it. Your crystal radio was a exciting device. You excited the whisker. And that's how you got
the signal. I've heard that if you didn't have a germanium diode or a cat's whisker, you can still make a crystal radio using a rusty razor blade.
Well, that's where I was going with this. The same principles that you would use in the crystal radio set of the early days is the same principles that plague us today in modern times. I'll have some fun with this. And it's annoying because you can't always track it down because it's excited by a source that you don't know. I could tell this from personal experience in working with a project this past year and helping a government agency troubleshoot a problem that created all kinds of issues. And we spent months trying to find and isolate this. And if you could just picture trying to figure out where an intermod third resultant interfering radio signal is appearing from the rooftop of several different skyscrapers in New York City, you can just imagine what we had to go through. I was on the top of the Citicorp building for many months, many hours, top of the Empire State Building, on top of the MetLife Building, on top of the Trump Tower Building, on top of some other building. I'm not even sure what the name of it is, but the agencies that were up there, we couldn't talk about what they did. And we were trying to triangulate by using directional antennas to point in the direction of the interfering passive intermodulation signal. Yeah. So this passive intermodulation signal was actually a byproduct of two other signals and created a third one. It landed right on a Coast Guard frequency.
I've heard this said maybe a little bit different way. And it's saying the same thing that you're saying, but I always heard the word, and I like this word, dissimilar metals. When you have
two dissimilar
metals in contact with each other, you can have a non-linear electrical connection. That is, electricity won't behave the same way going through that connection in one direction versus the other, or in either direction. It's nonlinear. It doesn't have a curve of voltage, current, resistance, and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't follow Ohm's law. How about that?
It becomes an unstable varactor. Basically.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Another way to say it.
What you're talking about is the same thing. There's similar metals. And that's why dissimilar metals have the same issue, and that's why you don't do aluminum with steel or copper. I forget what it is. There's a different ones.
But when
and you'll see
when
the
you
resulting
build,
act.
When you build flagpoles, towers, railings on buildings, as you mentioned, roof flashing. When you use building materials to make things, you end up with dissimilar metals touching each other, and you might end up with corrosion between two of the same metals, but the corrosion makes it dissimilar between the two. So you've got all these opportunities in an urban environment, at a tower farm or a rooftop location, to have dissimilar metals contacting each other. And when you have that, you have the opportunity for if you're in the field of, I guess it would take two, because one signal wouldn't necessarily do it, but two signals mixing on this dissimilar metal connection can very well result in that connection emitting intermodulation energy. That is energy at other frequencies besides the two that are hitting it, two or more that are hitting it. And so it can become a wildly complicated math matrix of how many different frequencies it could possibly be. So my quick story, similar to yours, is in Memphis, Tennessee. You've got a big high power radio station there, an FM, that's grandfathered in at 300 kilowatts. I think it's 300 kilowatts vertical and 100 kilowatts horizontal. It's WMC FM. And they're far enough from the airport for the towers to be legal, but the signal strength is just huge. And so you have a tower here, there you had a location, some FAA equipment in a building, and they were the problem was they kept complaining. Pilots kept complaining about hearing WMC on their aviation frequencies. Well, WMC wasn't transmitting on those frequencies, and it wasn't too hard to prove with a tap into the coax of WMC's transmitter and a spectrum analyzer. See, it's clean. We're not transmitting any energy on aviation band frequencies. We're totally legal, both near to the carrier, medium from the carrier, and at second, third, fourth, fifth harmonics from the carrier. Now, the aviation band is just above the FM band. I'm not sure what was mixing with what, but another FM station, for example, if WMC's on 100 megahertz and there's another station on, say, 92 megahertz, and they mix together and there's a resulting piece of energy at 108 megahertz, well, that it's the bottom of the aviation band right there. Aviation band 110, 114 megahertz, 125 megahertz. You can see that you can get energy into that band, and it was being caused by corroded connections. It turned out it was corroded connections on whip antennas that, if I'm not mistaken, that were in the charge of the FAA. It was their antennas that were actually had the dissimilar metal connection. But the broadcast engineers, since it appeared they were causing the problem, even though they weren't, they were charged with helping to track it down. And so over time, stuff gets rebuilt with better metals, better, newer stuff, hopefully better stuff, and we get rid of the problem over the long haul. But it's the kind of thing that can crop up again and again just because it's out in the environment.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of things that the environment destroys or, wreaks havoc on. That's why you want to galvanize metal when you're doing it outdoors and make sure that it's set up properly. What's that? Go ahead.
Does galvanization last forever or for the useful life of whatever's galvanized? Yeah. Or does it wear off?
It eventually wears off, but depending on if the process is done right, it'll last a long time.
Okay.
I've been at sites where it's been there for many, many, many years. I've also been at sites where people don't galvanize joints and all of a sudden they're coming back a year later to rusted angle iron. It's not good.
Ah, so if you've got a galvanized tower, and let's say you have one of those grounding kits for the coax, maybe an Andrew or cable wave or whatever grounding kit, and you might have a bolt hole in the tower. It's meant for it, but it's galvanized, and you cinch the bolt down. Don't you now have dissimilar metals? Maybe
yes,
because there. And if it's not tight, A lot of times, you know, nowadays, good practices, they'll go back and, well, first of all, they'll scrape it and then they'll bolt it together and then they'll go back and spray paint over it, or spray galvanization, or spray paint over it to keep moisture out over the long haul.
Yes, what you do is you scrape off the galvanizing to make the contact of the metal of the tower. Then you secure it, you weatherproof it, and then you secure it, and then you would spray a galvanizing paint, a material on that joint, so you restore the galvanizing effect, and then you paint over it for the tower painting purposes and just for weather protection. I was just talking to someone today about that regarding a microwave, ENG microwave receiver on top of a tower, and complaining about the grounding wasn't enough, and the lightning keeps blowing up the receivers. Then when he showed me the pictures of their setup, we're looking at the cables. I'm like, where is that ground wire going? He goes, well, here. I was like, well, that might be part of your problem. You didn't really ground it. So your nice 3-foot microwave spinning, microwave dish, 7-gig dish, is basically insulated from the tower and sitting out there waiting to get zapped. Sure enough, when we talked to the manufacturer, because he was like, no, that can't be it. The manufacturer comes over. It's a today's show, right at the CCW. And the application engineer, first question out of his mouth is, okay, you're on a tower. How high up? 300 feet. Okay. Where is this tower located? On a hill. Okay. We're here in the Northeast? Yes, it's over New Jersey. Okay, great. What kind of grounding did you do? Let me see the pictures. Yeah, that's your problem. Okay. And here's why that was the problem. The connection for the RF signal, the video for the return ENG signal from the helicopter, was being converted from RF to fiber and down the tower on fiber. So the fiber, you can't jump with the lightning. It's a non-conductor.
Right.
So he said the only other place that the lightning could wreak havoc is where you didn't properly ground it. It was the ground cable.
How does that receiver get power?
They have a 48 volt line that's also insulated. It runs with the fiber in a special is a mechanism they use for isolating for transient protection. Sorry, those are the two things. And but the thing was, he said, once you don't have a proper ground, the entire radome, the cover of the dish, the cover of the assembly, and the metal base that it sits on becomes just an antenna waiting to be zapped.
Yeah.
And then he showed us some pictures and other examples of other client locations where they had a similar situation. I was like, whoa, look at that. But yeah, you can galvanize the connection you make to the tower and restore it and make sure it's right. That's standard practice.
You're watching This Week in Radio Tech, or listening to it. It's with Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tobin. We're hoping that Dave Anderson could join us. Either he's en route or he's not going to be able to join us, but maybe he can in the last few minutes of the show. Dave's been on the show before, and he's done a lot of tower work this past summer. If he doesn't get on this time, we'll get him again another time. I know he was at an SBE NS workshop today in Tampa, and so we'd like to talk to him about that if he does show up here. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by Telos Systems, the folks that hire me, and I really appreciate that. I also appreciate them sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech, and I want to tell you about the Telos VX Broadcast Voice over IP phone system, VoIP phone system. It's the first VoIP phone system meant just for broadcasters. Now, here's what's cool about the Telos VX system. You can plug it directly into a source of Voice over IP. Let's say that you have an off-site VoIP provider. You can plug it right into the network cabling that carries you to your VoIP provider. Maybe you have an on-site PBX that is converting, maybe PRI or T1 or outside VoIP, and you're converting it to VoIP for inside your offices. You can connect it to that. You can also connect it to a gateway device. Maybe you have PRI coming in or POTS for your on-air lines. Put a gateway device and convert those lines over to SIP, Voice over IP with the SIP protocol, and hook that into the Telos VX. One more way, this is the really cool way that so many people are going with, get a VoIP PBX that you control, like an Asterisk-based VoIP PBX. You know, Asterisk seems like this big nebulous thing that we don't know about, but what we found out is engineer after engineer starts playing with Asterisk-based PBXs, maybe from Elastix or from ShoreTel, or maybe the one from called Free PBX. There's one you can download and play with. I've got one running on a Raspberry Pi just across my office here, and it actually works. And it talks to the Telos VX as well. I got a line here from it. Get familiar with this, and then guess what, Mr. Engineer? You get to be in control of your phone lines. You get to save your company a ton of money on phone lines, and you get incredible flexibility. Plus, if you do it right, You get higher audio quality on every call. We have had at Telos, we've had a customer after customer tell us that, man, the calls have never sounded this good. A major television network, actually two of them, have told us exactly that. Calls have never sounded this good. We're glad to put these calls on the air. And that's just regular, you know, G.711 phone calls. You can do more than that with the Telos VX. The VX can be used as a one-room system, but economically speaking, it spreads well over several rooms. You can run two control rooms, three. You could easily run 10 control rooms of telephone needs with one Telos VX engine. The VX engine, if you're already a customer that has Axia LiveWire, well, then you just plug the Telos VX directly into that network. No more money to spend except for just the phones and the VX box itself. If you don't have an Axia LiveWire network, no problem. You're still way under the cost of doing individual systems in each room. Just get an Axia X node for your audio inputs and outputs and attach that to the Telos VX system, and you can get audio in and out for your audio router, or you can put a node in each control room or production room to get caller audio and mix minus audio into and out of the system, as well as program on hold. There's a lot to talk about, a little bit to learn about on the Telos VX system. I will tell you this. There are now over 300 of them around the world at major networks, at small radio stations, at medium-sized radio stations. I've got one here in my office I make an occasional phone call on. It's really cool. And if you need to access it remotely for troubleshooting, you can do that too securely. So if you would, check out the Telos VX broadcast VoIP telephone system. It's on the web. It's at the Telos website. Just go to telos-systems.com and then look, under phones, just, you know, click on the Telos VX broadcast VoIP system. It's making a lot of folks very happy because it sounds great. And you switch your phone lines over to VoIP and you can really save money, save your company money and end up paying for the system, you know, in a year or two. So keep saving money after that too. Thanks a lot, Telos, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris Tobin, we have a video that I would like to watch a few minutes of. Sometime we're going to have this guy as a guest. He's really busy. He's hard to catch. It's John Hedish, and he runs Middle Tennessee Two-Way Service, I think is the name of his company. He's got a bunch of videos on YouTube, though. If you will go to YouTube and look up John Hedish, H-E-T-T-I-S-H, you'll find his channel, you'll find lots of videos, and he's all about tower safety, doing things right, and the guy's just amazing. He's part of our SBE chapter here in Nashville. So without much further ado, Andrew, can you show us a few minutes of this video, and Chris, take a good look and see if you can identify what John's doing here.
Okay.
Go ahead, Andrew. Ah, okay, we're starting at the beginning. All righty. So he's got, gotcha. He's got a SiteMaster. That's what he's got. There, answer my own question. All righty. All right, here's John up on a tower. Hope he's all properly tied off and everything. Now, this is going to be like Mystery Science Theater 3000. We can just talk here, okay, Chris? We can give a running commentary. Yeah. I asked for Andrew to have no audio from that because it's a bunch of wind noise. It's really windy.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure at that height, looking at that video, I definitely would see wind. Hear wind.
Yeah. Yeah. So it looks like he's got a little strap there he's tying off that goes to probably his piece of test equipment is in that bag. So we didn't get to see how it's hooked up to the coax. Looks like there's an antenna bracket to the left there.
Yeah, it's an Inritsu SiteMaster. It's a good product. It's a popular product.
Ah, okay. All right. Now, see, yeah. In my contract engineering work, and my current work, I've never gotten to use anything like this. So tell me about what this product does.
It's basically a very specialized spectrum analyzer, and you can use it for tuning up your HD signals for AM. You could use it for FM spectrum. In his case, he's probably using it for land mobile purposes. So you do you could check the antenna. What do you call it? I can't think of the name of the technique now. Oh, wow, that's good. You can check to see if the antenna is properly working, if it's tuned and if it's shorted or not.
Now, when I bought a spectrum analyzer years ago, back when they were still, so expensive, I couldn't afford much of one. But I didn't get the sweep generator option that came with it. But my understanding is you can get a spectrum analyzer with a sweep generator, so it will put out a signal that sweeps, and the spectrum analyzer sweeps at the same time and analyzes that signal, and you can see how a signal gets accepted or rejected by what you're connected to.
Yes, I have a cell site tester. Mine is a traditional, very large, you know, size of a milk crate spectrum analyzer that I use for tuning up duplexers and filters for ham radio as well as broadcast. And it has a tracking generator in it, and that's what we do. We sweep the frequencies in, and on the display, you'll get either a peak, it looks like a peak for passing the frequency you want, or you get what looks like in a V, the letter V, and at the base of the V is where it's rejecting the signal that you want. So that's what you'd use a tracking generator for. And the Iritsu is the same thing I have, but now miniaturized because they can do that, and it's pretty cool what you can do with that. So he's probably doing exactly that, sweeping it with the line, looking at an antenna and seeing what's going on.
Now, I was going to ask, why would he be doing this way up the tower instead of at the bottom? I guess because he doesn't want the coax to be part of the measurement equation.
Right. Well, you have to bear in mind, if your antenna, say, let's just assume it's a UHF antenna, standard land mobile antenna, so it's a white stick. People see these all the time. And it's a white stick, so it's basically a collinear antenna. So it's literally, if you can picture segments of pieces of coax that are cut and loop back and forth in a vertical position. That's how it basically looks. In there, if one of those segments shorts out, the antenna will still function, but not the way it should. Your transmission line could hide or mask, that is, the problem of the length of the line, the standing waves and everything else. And that's part of what, that's why the Iritsu product and there's other products, Agilent and others, that a lot of times now you have to go up to the antenna and look at it. You know, back in the day, you didn't have to because in most cases you could go up to an FM. No, the rototiller.
He's looking at, he's looking at an FM antenna here. Okay.
Yeah, the rototiller just to the left of the screen down the low. That's an ERI rototiller. Most times you can go up, look at it, and see if there's any physical damage, and you didn't have to pull.
Now that interbay line right there looks brand new. Look how shiny the copper, the brass is there, or copper. Maybe he had to replace some interbay line or a bay on that antenna, and now he's going back to measure. Maybe that's it.
That's very possible. In the interbay, and depending on the design, you have ferrites that are used to tune the section, tune out any interaction between the bays. So it's hard to see with the display what he's trying to do. I can't make out. Looks like he's doing a sweep.
We'll have John on the show sometime, and we'll get him to tell us about that. And it's kind of fun here to guess what he's doing.
But now, mind you, I've done this kind of work, and not at that height, but it looks easy in this video, but you have a lot of things working against you at this point. Picture your body weight now just hanging, and your 2 feet on it. And if you look to the right hand side of his hand, you see those struts, those pipes of metal rods. If you can think of the arch of your foot, is sitting on that. Okay.
Yeah.
Not your entire foot. Not from toe to heel. Just the arch.
Right. Right.
Depending on the type of shoes you're properly using, you should be using steel shanks to help support the weight. You stay on that little piece of metal for an hour, a half hour, and eventually your legs start to feel.
And
I could tell you that it's not fun. Plus, at the same time, you're trying to work and do things, so you're tied to the tower and hang. You're not flush against it, but you can see how he's moving and notice it's very very labored movement. It's not just hey, let's move around and do stuff.
I got to believe that if you can do what John's doing here, you can go fix the Hubble Space Telescope.
It does take a certain type of person to do this kind of
work. A lot of the same skills involved here with deliberate movements, being very deliberate on everything you do. Now he's moving away from it. I wonder why. Maybe he's got to go. He's got to go. Maybe attach the coax to someplace. He's hooking on. There's a safety line. Okay, that's the line that
he should have two of those. There's the other one. And then he has a third one that actually is over his shoulders so that if he slips, it grabs him. And you'll see it. I saw the red lanyard. That's the one on the right-hand side. It came over his shoulder in one of the earlier shots. Okay. That's what I have on my climbing belt.
I got some heat on Facebook for not having proper climbing gear, and so I got proper climbing gear. Last time I climbed the tower, had two of those. That's a great knee shot there, John. That's just awesome.
I guess that's a helmet cam.
Yes. He's got a GoPro. He's loving the GoPro cameras, and he's loving doing these videos. There's just a ton of them on YouTube. You know, if I didn't have so much to do, this is entertainment. I could, and it's nice hearing what John says. I asked Andrew not to do the audio because it's just so much wind noise that it's you really got to pay attention to hear what John's saying. And a few of these, I think he's gone back and narrated them after the fact, so you don't have all that noise.
Yeah, it can be very noisy up there, definitely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
it looks like it's a good day for him.
And that's probably somewhere in Middle Tennessee. And I got to, it's a beautiful part of the world to climb. I know there's lots of places that are green and pretty and have lots of trees.
If you look down at when they show his feet, you'll notice his entire body weight, now and gravity's working with you, is on the arch of his shoe. So I'm just saying that because I've done this, and I applaud people who do tower work. It is not easy.
Especially if you don't do it very often. That's when you really don't have the muscles.
Yeah.
To support what you're doing.
You get a really good workout. I will tell you that. You will find out you have muscles you didn't know existed after you've done a tower climb for a day.
John here, I don't think I'm speaking out of school. He is either 70 years old or close to it. And this man is fit as a fiddle.
Oh, yeah. I used to have a guy who used to do tower work for me years and years ago. He was 73. Still climbing the tower, and you watch him go up. And if you didn't meet him at the base of the tower when he started, and you just happened to come to the job after he's halfway up, you'd swear he was a young guy. You'd watch him go up and spin around, not spin, but move from side to side on the tower face and move up and down. And then his son, who worked with him, was, I think, 55. It was like, and when they came down after the job was done, people would look around like, that was you up there? And the guy's like, yeah, what's the matter? Am I too old? If you stay in shape and keep your wits about you and there's no reason why you can't do it. And yeah, he's doing a sweep. It looks like that's a sweep pattern. I recognize that from my unit.
So it has a dip in the middle. It goes down, and is that where things are resonant?
It could be he could be looking for resonance, or he's looking to see the rototillers typically are not center frequency. That's intentional.
Right.
And the reason it's intentional is because of a detuning of icing on the antenna. Now, I'm not sure in that part of Tennessee if icing is a concern, but
I know in the Northeast.
I know in the Northeast they purposely tune it off frequency just a little bit.
Wow.
Oh, there's a transmission line that's unterminated.
Ah, there you go. Okay, so he's at the it must be a center fed antenna. He's at the center point of that antenna because I've seen hard line that goes above. We see bays below. He's at the top of the coax. So this has to be the center feed of that antenna. Might be a 6 or 8 bay antenna. Who knows?
But the ERIs typically have fed from the bottom. That transmission line didn't look like it was part of the antenna.
Oh, I've seen it. No. The black isn't. But
the other one. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but I'm
assuming the bays are turned off at the moment, right?
I thought I'd seen center-fed ERIs. I guess you're right. They're much more commonly bottom-fed. But if the power's high enough, you want to feed them in the center, don't you?
It depends. Yeah, I take that back. It depends. But the black coax is not part of the antenna system.
There it is. There's the I just saw it. There was an adapter on the bottom of the somewhere on the bottom of the center point of the antenna, and that adapter. Adapts, the inch and 5/8 or whatever size it is, down to the N connector.
To the end, yeah.
There it is. Oh, it's 3 1/8.
Oh, okay, there you go. So that camera made it look like the cable was smaller. So that's what it was. Got it.
Well, the cable still may be inch and 5/8, but that input connector, that's a 3 1/8 inch connector, right? Unless it's 2 1/4, but of course it's off the screen. I just can't hardly see it. Well, I kind of like this play-by-play.
Look at the inside of that center conductor, that Teflon, pretty black.
On the top of the coax? Yeah, I didn't.
On the top of the coax, yeah.
Yeah. The antenna's been there a while, but the interbay line is new. That's what I said earlier.
I wonder if this was a catastrophic failure of something, and that's why he's changing this out.
I'll bet you it was. I'll bet you it was. Yeah. All right, guys. Oh. It was a three-inch flange there, it said. There you go. Okay, it was, 3 1/8. All right. Hey, our show is brought to you in part by friends at Axia Audio. And I want to tell you about Axia Audio and their consoles. I just visited this really cool place in L.A. I visited a place called Dash Radio. Now, I know I can't give you a lot of websites here. Sometime in your free time, you might want to check out dashradio.com. It's an online. They have 60 channels of streaming audio, all kinds. You know, they kind of specialize in hip hop and new rock and a lot of stuff that, frankly, I'm unfamiliar with nowadays. But they have a great iOS app. Well, Dash Radio was the brainchild of DJ Ski. I don't know DJ Ski. Got to meet him, though. Really cool guy. And also a guy named John Halterman, who's the operations director there at Dash Radio. These guys are using Axia consoles. They have two rooms that they use for live productions. They have a big Axia Element console in one room, and they do all kinds of fun talk shows and talk about music, talk about life, those shows air on one of their channels. They've got another smaller production room that they do go live from time to time. They also do production there. And they have an Axia Radius console in there. And the place is just great. It's just delightful to see people. And these guys aren't in the licensed broadcast business. They're in the streaming business. So what I'm getting at is content creators. Content creators, no matter where you're going with your content, how you distribute it, you need equipment that's reliable. It works. It works just like secondhand. And you can just expect the way it's going to work. You don't have to fiddle with it and diddle with it. It's just going to work for you. And that's what the folks at Dash Radio like about their Element console and their Radius audio console, both from Axia. And guess what? They talk to each other. One cable between them from the trunk ports on they have a power station there, and they have the core 32 for the Radius console, and just plug them together with a piece of Cat 6, and all of a sudden they're talking to each other. It's really cool. And I got some of these consoles myself at our stations in American Samoa. I got an Element console at our station in Greenville, Mississippi. And I just love these things. Andrew Zarian's got a Radius console there at his place there at the GFQ network. One of the best things about these consoles, if you're going to bring in people remotely to talk, to laugh, have fun, comment on things like Andrew does, like other podcasters do, you're going to want your console to handle mix minus. That's a big problem because so many people get into producing shows and they don't know what mix minus is. And they have all this echo going on. It's just a mess. Well, Chris Tobin can certainly attest to this. I can too, and other guests of Andrew can too. The audio is always perfect. I never hear myself back in my earphone. I always hear the other guests and hear Andrew. It's just amazing the way that the Mix Minus works on this console. And you may think, Mix Minus, I've never heard of that. I don't know how it works. Is it important to me? Yeah, it's real important to you. If you're going to talk to anybody on the phone, on a codec, on Skype, even people in the studio, you want the back feed, whether it's an actual mix minus feed or a mix of everything feed, you want that to be right. And Axia consoles do that automatically. It's one of the big features, and it was a really innovative feature when it came out about 11 years ago, and it still is today because it works so perfectly well. It's just amazing. I'd like you to check out these consoles. If you need a small console for your podcast studio, for your streaming audio radio station, for your broadcast station, for your TV station. Yeah, there's Element consoles in TV stations running audio for newscasts and programs and local productions. They work just great for that. Check it out, axiaaudio.com. I'm so excited. I hope you can tell. I'm so excited about the technology because it just freaking works. Man, axiaaudio.com. Good stuff. All right, Chris Tobin, this has been episode number 235. Any closing thoughts about solving problems on towers way up there in the air where you can't get to them easily?
Well, I guess you have to take a methodical, measured approach to your problems. So if you're an FM station and you're having issues with your signal and you think it's a tower-related issue, I guess the first thing to look at is your reflected signal. See if it's modulated with your carrier. If it's modulating with your carrier, odds are you have a problem with the antenna itself. Check your nitrogen tanks if you're doing nitrogen to pressurize the line. See if there's a pattern if you're making weekly measurements and keeping track of the pressure. Look to see if you're noticing a dip or rise in pressure depending on the weather, because as the days get warm and cold, the cable contracts and expands. And if there's a slit in the transmission line, when the cable expands, it'll seal up and the pressure will stabilize. When it gets cold, it'll open and you'll lose pressure and your nitrogen tank will start to deplete. Or if you're running a compressor, then your compressor alarm should go off saying, hey, I'm running continuously now for the last 6 hours and I shouldn't be doing that. Those are the early, like, that's the early onset of what could be going wrong if you want to, you know, get an idea of things. And something else, if you happen to be listening to your FM signal and you're hearing crackling sounds and you know it's not coming from your audio transmission, your audio line, odds are your antenna elements are arcing. So you, you definitely want to. I worked at a station, I worked with a station that was hit by, not directly hit by lightning, but, you know, corona discharge was nearby. And it shorted one of the bays in such a weird way that is a, there's an insulator across the ring of the bay that carbon built up. And so it just started shorting. And as the station was modulating, the signal was going. And the moisture in the air would affect it. So at night, when it got real dry, it was like, what the heck is that sound on the radio? And we went out to the tower site with binoculars, looked up at the bays, and you could see a little flickering light.
Oh, never good. The bay
hurts. Never good. So, sort of like St. Elmo's fire on a winter day.
You know, that reminds me. I had a station that we could hear crackling on the air, and it was after a storm had gone through, and nobody had noticed. But it turned out that one of the guy wires had broken.
Oh.
And it was the guy wire that went above the FM antenna. So, and I don't know if it was done right or I mean, I don't think it had breakup insulators. I know it wasn't Philly strand. So I think it was steel guy wire now just flopping around and hitting some of the antenna bays. And whenever that would happen, of course, it would oddly enough, the transmitter didn't seem to care. But you could hear this noise on the air. In fact, it was also because of that arcing was making all kinds of spectrum up and down the FM dial and above. It was knocking out
that's known
the
as a spark gap transmitter.
Yes, it was knocking out the satellite receiver. Whenever the wind would blow and it would start really crackling, the satellite receiver would go out because I'm sure there's all kinds of who knows what kind of RF being produced right there in the area, right near the satellite dish. I mean, just a couple hundred, 400 feet up or so.
Well, yeah, you're basically creating wideband noise, ultra wideband noise. So the satellite downlink, which is what, 3 gig, 3.7 gig, 3.4 gig?
Yeah.
So wideband noise. Remember, the satellite signal is what? How many microwatts? and how many volts per meter is the spark gap transmitter above it?
It's bigger than I can show. Yeah, pretty huge.
Exactly. So you're just swamping that LNB. Was just like, what the hell is that?
You know, it was fun. The troubleshooting actually was pretty easy. We stood around inside the building, you know, scratching ourselves for a while, thinking, oh, what could this be? Finally, I don't know. I went outside for some reason, heard a noise, turned around, looked at the tower, thought, well, there's the problem. Right, there's your problem right there. You guy wires hitting the FM antenna.
So. Nothing beats getting a phone call what was it? 1-8, was it 1 a.m.? Midnight? Around that time. From your local police department telling you that your tower is on fire. Can you come down to the transmitter building? We don't know what to do. I'm like, the tower is on fire? It's made of metal. Non-flammable paint. Are you sure? Because there's no grass around. We have gravel 200 feet around the building. What could possibly be burning? I don't know, but it's vertical, horizontal. It's all over the place. Okay, this is really interesting. I'm on my way. I get down there, and mind you, this is an interesting look. You know, you're driving down the street. You see your tower. It's a 475-foot tower, and the tallest structure nearby is about 2 stories high. So you get a clear view of this for several miles. And I, believe it or not, I see what looks like flashes of light coming off the vertical parts of the tower and some of the horizontal guy anchors. I'm like, what the devil? It turns out to be a very dry night. It was a light dusting of snow. And as it was described to me when I went to one of the schools and talked to the physics teachers, it's a form of St. Elmo's fire.
Hmm.
So it was static. The RF signal from the AM station. It was AM station, 5/8 wave. So there's a lot of current there. So the snow and the water pellets of the snow flakes as they brushed along the metal structure got ionized. The air was dry enough that there was no insulation. The air wasn't damp enough to create. So it was just perfect conditions. And I kid you not, it was just like sparks everywhere. It's like, look at that. Fire department was just about to slam in the door with the axes when I got there. I was like, oh, thank goodness I got here in time.
What were they going to do? Aim the hoses up at the tower?
They had fire hose at the door. And I'm like, oh, there goes the Continental.
Oh, no. Well, I'm glad you stopped them. And so I've never seen St. Elmo's fire on a tower, luckily. So I haven't seen that going on up there, but I've heard stories and seen pictures.
Yeah, that was amazing the only time I witnessed it. That was the only time, but I would say it was fun. It was interesting. 2 o'clock in
Chris,
the morning.
We got to go. This has been fun. We're going to have John Hedish on, I promise you, on some future episode. He will join us. We'll get Dave Absolutely. Anderson on. He was probably stuck in traffic in Tampa. I know he had a tough way to go to try to get home to join us. So we'll have him on another time. But thank you for being here and your play-by-play commentary on the tower climb and the troubleshooting and your good advice on towers and solving problems when they're way up in the air.
Maybe what I'll do is if we have John on, I will see if I can arrange. I'll get my gear on and hang from the base of a tower here in Manhattan and just do the show from there.
Sure, wouldn't be the craziest place you've done one.
That's true.
Hey, our show this week in Radio Tech has been brought to you by Lavo and the Crystal Clear virtual radio console. Thanks to Lavo. Also, Telos and the Telos VX voice over IP phone system. It is amazing. Save you money. Sounds fabulous. Also, it does HD voice. I didn't get to tell you that. Check it out on the website. And also Axia and the Axia line of audio consoles, including the beautiful big honking Element console and the cute little Radius console that just does all kinds of good stuff too. Axia Audio on the web, axiaaudio.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks very much to Andrew Zarian for producing tonight's show. And we hope you'll tell your friends about us. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And we'll see you next time on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.